Previously on Beta.
His dramatic weight gain can only be explained by the fact that he must be eating all the food sent back to the kitchen.
A couple of years ago, I posted this model of Sisyphus pushing his boulder, and I was pretty happy with it at the time.
What have you done to it? What have you done to its eyes?
He has his father's eyes.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, MacArthur genius Karen Russell talks about the stories in her latest collection, Orange World.
The story is kind of a love triangle between a very young couple that are on a road trip. And then on this trip, the girl pricks her finger on a Joshua tree. There's this uncanny merger. She is infiltrated by the plant's spirit. And the story sort of proceeds from there.
Also, indie musician Andrew Bird tells us about his latest album, My Finest Work Yet, which just might be his finest work yet.
And that's why an album hangs together, sometimes thematically, not just lyrically, but with melodies and ideas, is that if it sounds familiar later on in the record, it's because they used to be in the same song together.
But first, Chef Roy Choi. Roy was one of the pioneers of the gourmet food truck movement in L.A. with his Korean taco truck, Kogi. He was also the inspiration for and technical advisor on the 2014 film Chef with Jon Favreau. These days, he's keeping busy with a pair of docuseries TV shows, KCET's Broken Bread and Netflix's The Chef Show. But there's a long road his food truck had to travel to get there. When Roy was 24, he had just dropped out of law school and had no direction.
I was lying on a couch in West L.A. and the Essence of Emerald show came on. Uh-huh. And I had an out-of-body experience. I don't know how else to put it. And I just knew that cooking was going to be something. It was like my last hope.
Wow. And so, and you've actually said, haven't you, that Emerald saved your life?
I mean, that moment saved my life.
Yeah.
I mean, He physically didn't save my life, but through the television screen he did, yeah.
Wow, sure. Do you remember what it was you saw that when you had this epiphany? Like what he was cooking? Do you happen to remember?
Yeah, he was making a braised beef dish. It was either beef bourguignon or braised short rib or red wine braised beef, something like that.
Now, let's check the sides. You see that? Got a little color to them now. They've been seared. All right, I'll show you how easy this is.
Yeah, and so that inspired you to enroll in culinary school.
Yes, it did.
Yeah, wow, and then here we go. And then that set you on the path. You were a food truck pioneer. You were the first food truck operator to be named one of Food & Wine magazine's top 10 best new chefs. What did you learn about food and about yourself during your food truck career?
Well, one is we learned that we were a lineage of the food trucks before us and mm-hmm. all of the street food and the vendors mm-hmm. and the culture that existed before us. And we looked at ourselves as like the children of that foundation. And what we did was we brought technology to it. For me personally, it opened up, if Emerald's show found me a path, Kogi 20 years later allowed me to really find out my purpose of how to feed people.
Anthony Bourdain wrote that Roy Choi first changed the world when he elevated the food truck concept from roach coach to highly sought after, ultra hot yet democratic rolling restaurant. Was that something you were consciously trying to do?
Kogi started out as a very simple idea. It was just a couple friends getting together and we just wanted to park in front of the nightclubs, make a few $100. And we were all out of a job and I had gotten laid off a few months earlier and we were just looking to get by until we got our next job, and it just turned into this thing. Again, it started really simple, but as it grew and as the flash mobs grew and the streets got filled with this energy and as people started to hear about it and Twitter started to mushroom, it changed me, it changed our team, and it changed the way we all look at these things. When Anthony Bourdain mentions the word roach coach, a lot of food trucks and street vendors were looked at in a very racist way, mm-hmm. in a very prejudicial way. And so they were labeled as dirty, as roach coaches, as things you wouldn't eat. And now they're gourmet. So I don't think the trucks and the food before us changed. It's just America's perception of them changed through the process of Kogi.
Hmm.
And so that definitely was something that was very deep. It changed my life.
Yeah, and then a few years later, Jon Favreau is making a movie called Chef, which was loosely inspired by you and the food truck movement. And you ended up working as a technical advisor on the film. How did that happen?
We just got put together through our peoples, you know. Here in L.A., we got peoples.
Of course,
and,
yeah.
And his people, my peoples, we all became peoples. And and we just hit it off on day one. You know, he needed a technical advisor. The script was already written. They were already about to go into pre-production. And he just needed a technical, just like if it was a dancing movie or a boxing movie, he would need a professional, like he would need like Teddy Atlas to teach him how to box, right?
The fun part is watching Roy get the stuff ready for this. So I try to watch him when he's preparing, I try to copy him. I can't do it, I can get some of it.
Because we hit it off from day one, that technical advisor role, actually we became really great friends and inseparable. And so it wasn't about the work or the job so much anymore, it was about the art. Of the movie. And so we really, it was like creating a band, you know. There were no borders or barriers. We just went in and tried to do the best we could.
Yeah. You've reunited with Jon Favreau for this new show, the Chef Show on Netflix. Can you tell me a bit about this show?
Yeah. Jon and I really love hanging out with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And when the movie ended, it felt like summer camp was over. And so it was like we just searched for reasons and situations where we could continue to hang out. And then he brought a camera one day and he called me. He was filming in Atlanta for Avengers and Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, listen, you know, I have this idea. Why don't you just come out to Atlanta? And I don't know what it is yet, but I'll turn on the camera and we can just start cooking and talking, and I'll invite some friends over. And then I fly over there and I find out the friends are Spider-Man and Iron Man and the Avengers cast. And I'm like, okay,
that's great.
Let's go.
That's great. So it sounds like it's a lot of fun to do this.
Oh, it was great.
Yeah. These days you're working on your TV show, Broken Bread. What are you trying to accomplish with Broken Bread?
We're trying to make the good in the world, the people that are going against the grain, trying to look at the problems, the broken systems, social injustice, social justice, activism. We want to make those topics, those really important topics, a part of pop culture and a part of primetime television.
Mm-hmm. And you also, as you say at the beginning of each episode, food doesn't just nourish us when we're hungry. It can be a catalyst for change.
For change, yeah.
Yeah,
so the show is really a catalyst for change.
Yeah.
And really the purpose of the show is to find that balance between entertainment and something to make you think and something to make you care.
Yeah.
You know?
And the first episode is called Transformation, and one of the people you talked to in this episode is Mar Diego, the owner of Dough Girl. Can you tell me a bit about Mar and Dough Girl?
Yeah, it's up in an area here in Los Angeles called The Valley, and it's a small little pizza shop, but really big dreams of, and not just dreams, but reality of changing kids' lives. So there are issues within this country that we don't want to confront, and that's teenage homelessness and teenage opioid addiction. Those are two very difficult problems that we have for our youth.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times our educational system and our support systems don't allow for rehabilitation away from those things. And so a lot of these kids get lost within that void. And so what Mar does is she just brings these kids in, because a big area where a lot of these kids kind of live on the streets is right across from her pizza shop in the riverbed.
Mm.
And so she brings them into the shop and then gives them jobs and training. And the whole shop is run by these kids that would be sleeping on the streets, but now have a job, have a paycheck. There's like subsidy apartments that she sets up so that they can stay there. And so it's a really wonderful thing. And it's very micro, one pizza at a time, one kid at a time, and then just brick by brick. And now there's like 30 kids.
Jay slept in that corner over there to the left for 6 months. So he would get up, open the ovens. I'd catch him dancing at night, cleaning. You know what I mean?
That's amazing.
It was just like it brought it to him. It wasn't about me anymore. It wasn't about the hustle. It was more about the purpose of changing one's life. So the reaction to him coming from the streets, coming into the kitchen, and me saying yes was like, boom.
You know, we have these huge world problems, right? Whether it's hunger, homelessness, food access, waste, all these things, monoagriculture. And we feel like we can't find a solution towards these things. Yeah. What we're trying to show in Broken Bread is that the solution lies maybe back in the brick by brick. It really does. And there are echo effects to that. And Mar Diego is one example. But as you go through the show, you'll see even larger examples of that.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes me think of especially that episode about the Watts neighborhood in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And in this episode, you say that Watts is a place plagued by misconceptions and that if you really want to understand this neighborhood, you have to get to know the people. Your tour guide in Watts is a guy named Akilah Shirelles. Can you tell me a bit about him?
He is a leader and activist within the community of not only South Central Los Angeles, Watts, but also in Newark, New York. And he's someone that really advocates for peace. He brokered the peace treaty in 1992 between the gangs in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Yeah, he worked with the legendary football player Jim Brown, right?
Yes, he did. To broker
this peace treaty between the rival gangs, the Crips and Bloods. I'm curious about what impact this peace treaty had on Watts and the people who lived there.
Well, it lasted for a long time. It lasted for a little over 10 years. So one thing that did happen is there's something called peace treaty babies.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, before the peace treaty, if you were from different hoods, you couldn't really travel to those hoods.
Mm-hmm.
But once the peace treaty opened up, which meant that now you could interact with the different projects in the different hoods,
So
a lot of people hooked up and made babies.
Mm, interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting, yeah. So how did the police who worked in Watts feel about it?
On a serious level, it's a beautiful thing because there are too many young people being killed within our inner cities for no reason,
mm-hmm.
you know, and throughout this country, we're led to believe, especially if you're in a situation where you're not marginalized, you're led to believe that the police are there to protect you.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
And in most cases, that's what the system is set up for.
Yeah.
But we have to acknowledge that there is a part of the system that is broken, which is that African-American youth and the African-American community is targeted by the police department.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And profiled, and they benefit off of the violence.
Like the first 2 years of the peace treaty, man, gang homicides dropped 44% in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So then we learned real quick about the economics of law enforcement, that they was actually invested in the problem. So every time a shooting happens, they roll out more cops, and now there's overtime money. And so, you know, there was this cop, man, Sunshine. When we were celebrating the peace treaty, Sunshine had drove up and stuff. And we was like, Sunshine. We was like, man, the peace treaty, oh, man, ain't you happy? You ain't got to worry about no mm-hmm. more. He was like, man, he told me, it'd be a cold day in hell before I ever support the peace treaty. He said, I make $50,000 a year as a base salary. He said, I make another $60,000 in overtime. He said, I'm putting my daughter through college on your ignorance.
What Akilah was referring to is that they thought that the police department would be in same celebration as them, that finally we've ended the war.
Yeah, exactly. You know? That's what I thought too, yeah.
But what they found out was that they weren't happy because the war actually paid for their salaries, their overtime. And so that was a revelation to them.
Yeah.
And this was in the early 90s before the last 5 years where a lot of police brutality has been shared online and through Facebook and through, you know, phone capture.
Yeah.
And so this was a complete surprise because, you know, they thought that they had done something that the government and that the system was going to support and applaud, but they realized they were part of a deeper spiral.
Yeah. As a chef, you see the world through the lens of food, and based on what you've seen so far through your work on Broken Bread, what do you think about the future of food, the future of people, and the future of our planet?
What we try to do through the show is show that there are— the problem is huge, but the solution is actually closer than you think.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to make these conscious choices, which aren't like choices of like completely changing your life and not having fun. It's like you could still kind of live the same life you live, but if you make just these very slight, simple choices,
mm-hmm.
that it would have a huge effect on these issues that we bring up. Because when you hear the headlines and you just read the clickbait of the news, you think that there is no hope, right?
Yes, yes.
And so the show is like, wait a second, let's get past the headline. Let's go out and search for the people really doing things on the ground, what I call, like, you know, the earthworms and the ants, like the things you don't see. And we wanted to put the camera and put light to that, because there are a lot of movements going on, whether it's underground, whether it's emerging, whether it's big corporate like a Beyond Meat that we cover.
Most people think about meat and say, well, meat comes from a chicken, cow, or pig. What we do as a company is we think somewhat differently about meat. What we think about is really the composition of meat. It's these amino acids, lipids, it's trace minerals, trace amount of vitamins, and it's predominantly water. A lot of cuts of meat are 67% water, as you know, as a chef. So why don't we think about building meat differently?
Wow.
There's nothing in the animal that's so special that you couldn't pull that out of plants.
There are people out there fighting and showing you that there is a way to fix this. We just got to have compassion. We got to believe them. And we have to see the truth in what they're doing. Because they're not doing it to convince you. They're doing it because they know that what's happening right now in certain systems are broken, and they're doing things that they know that can help it and fix it. And it goes as small as delivering one box of organic produce at a time throughout South Central Los Angeles, to one pizza at a time to save a kid in the valley, or creating a plant-based protein meat that could replace sausages, hot dogs, and hamburgers.
Yeah, exactly. It makes me think of the Bruce Springsteen song title, "From Small Things, Big Things One Day Come." So it's got to start with
there
small
it is.
Stuff.
That's, there you go. That's exactly it.
Roy Choi, thank you very much.
Oh, man, thank you.
Roy Choi is a celebrity chef and the host of Broken Bread. He also co-hosts the Netflix series The Chef Show with filmmaker Jon Favreau. You can find out more about Roy on our website, wpr.org/beta.
My favorite period of recording was like 58 to 62 jazz records that were made in that time.
Andrew Bird talks about the sound he was going for on his latest album. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Andrew Bird is a multi-instrumentalist, singer, and songwriter. He's taken a different approach on his latest album, My Finest Work Yet. On this album, Andrew comments on current events, including political polarization and climate change. He hopes that this album will help influence the conversations we have.
I wanted to make one that was kind of everything that I value put into one album.
Mm-hmm.
There's no, like, sometimes with an album, I'll be like, okay, I'm going to flip the script or something like that. But with this one, I was like, I'm going to do my thing that I've honed over the years and just do my best version of myself that I can do. I started writing it, you know, in 2016, and they're just a reaction. They're just my reaction to being alive at this time. Whereas my previous record was a little more about up-close, personal, emotional things, this one's a little more geopolitical or social in what I'm addressing.
Yeah, it's very much responding to current events.
Yeah. It took me a while to find the right vocabulary for it, because current events are a tricky area to navigate in a song.
So can you talk a bit about how you went about finding the right vocabulary?
When you bring a person or a place or that's in the last 5 or 10 years, we tend to devalue the current moment. It's not history yet, you know? So, and history has weight to it, and current events just feel like a farce right now.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe in 20 years we'll look back and it'll have this sort of historical weight to it. So you look for analogs in history that are nearby that some people are familiar with that might help shine a light on what's happening now. So Catalonia 1936, or I fall back on just, you know, the classic Greek myths. Those are solid standbys.
I've read that you said that with this album, you don't know if you can change minds, but at least you can hopefully get people talking about the current events, our current situation, in a different way. How do you think this album can change the conversations that people are having?
Yeah, I try to approach subjects like, instead of like the listing off data points or facts or being another talking head, I was trying to look at it like, for instance, the song Manifest, it just takes a broad view of what fossil fuels really are. There's something kind of poetic, though frightening, about the whole thing. Like, there's this thing that was once alive that dies, and some of its carbon energy is still contained, even though it's dead, and it gets compressed underground, and then millions of years later, it gets pulled out of ground and put into an engine to drive an automobile or whatever, and the vapor escapes into the atmosphere. But we're like taking that last bit of energy from that once living thing.
I'm coming to the brink of a great disaster, and just has to be near. The earth spins faster, whistles right past you, whispers death in your ear. Don't pretend you can't hear.
I feel like if I lay things out in this way, like, yeah, maybe you're not going to change any minds, but, like, can you really argue with what I'm saying? You
know? No, I can't, yeah.
I don't know. I grew up in the Midwest, not always living amongst people that I agree with, and that is to say I haven't always lived in the coastal bubbles, and, you know, I want to talk about it with people. There's, like, things we're not talking about. When I leave the States on tour, I have very open conversations, but it's become so toxic here, it's hard to talk.
I've read that you're very interested in the idea of what constitutes a moral compass. How so? Mm-hmm.
You know, like 20 years ago or so, there was talk of family values in the context of, like, you know, this idea of morality being a set thing. And now here I feel like everything's turned upside down. It's funny that maybe we'll be looking to our rock stars now for a moral compass, you know? Because there's that idea, is there morality in outer space?
Mm-hmm.
Where is the, it's just a construct, right?
Yeah.
But you have to believe in times like these that there is a right and a wrong. Like, I didn't always feel like I had to choose sides before, but now it feels like there's a very clear, clearly something wrong going on.
What if one day we just refuse to play? With no one to hate, they'd be out of a charge.
And so that's why this album has a certain urgency to it that I haven't really felt before.
Hmm. The opening song on the new album, My Finest Work Yet, is called Sisyphus. Can you tell me a bit about this song?
Yeah. That's addressing this moral question in a way. You know, Sisyphus was the Greek king who got in trouble for cheating death, and he escaped from Hades, and Zeus found out and sentenced him to an eternity of pushing a rock up a hill. So it's become this kind of, you hear it a lot referenced in TV shows, and it seems to be something happening in the zeitgeist with that myth these days. I focus on the moment when Sisyphus gets to the top of that mountain and actually feels like he might have a choice. Either he's going to jump and end the struggle or let the rock roll down. And I imagine, like, who's down there when the rock rolls down? Like, is there a village that's getting destroyed, you know? He's in a quandary of, like, what's my responsibility to the community at large? I know this is not serving me as an individual, but that's where the second verse is, I'd rather fail like a mortal than flail like a god.
Sisyphus peered into the mist, a stone stole from a precipice, paused.
Sisyphus opens with whistling, and whistling, of course, is one of the recurring features in your music. It's very effective and very memorable. Why do you like to feature whistling in so many of your songs? Is there something about the oral texture of it, or?
Yeah, it didn't occur to me to do it for the first three records because it's such a casual thing, and I spent 20 years and now 40 years trying to master this difficult instrument. And then to accept that the money's in whistling is a little hard to
But it seems to be, though, because you've been hired for your whistling stylings. You were featured in the final scene of the 2011 Muppets movie, and comedian Zach Galifianakis asked you to score his TV show Baskets. So maybe an all-whistling album is in the future.
You know, at first I was resistant because it's so synonymous with whimsy, and that word's been used in connection with my music, and it bothers me. So I, especially with Sisyphus, I sought out to, like, make that melody as badass as possible, like wind in your hair. Mm-hmm. But also kind of, I also see the wind in your hair, like, triumphant as well.
Yes.
But there's melancholy in almost every melody that I write.
This is your 14th album. What kind of sound were you going for with this album?
You know, my favorite period of recording was, like, 58 to 62 jazz records that were made in that time.
Mm-hmm.
The Van Gelder recordings and the Verve records and small group jazz from that period. Going into, like, Nina Simone, Herbie Hancock, you know, that was my template for this sonically. It was that jazz to pop to gospel kind of thing that was going on, pre-Beatles recording. And what I love about those recordings is that you can hear the room. So I'm singing in the room with the drums, and they're 6 feet away from me, and they're getting in my microphones, and I'm getting in everyone else's microphones, and you just have to make that not sound like a mess and make it sound beautiful.
Was it a lot of trial and error?
It took us maybe 2 or 3 days to get the first song, and then when we did Bloodless Second, when that came back through the speakers, it was like, that's it. That's pretty much the rough mix from the session.
Yeah.
Just the way the drums resonate in the room on that song.
Can you tell me a bit about the song Bloodless?
I'm just talking about how there's a lot of money being made in divisiveness.
They're profiting from your worry. Selling blanks down at the DMZ.
So it was written between the election and Charlottesville. But it's there's a lot going on there in that song. But I felt like I had to say something, you know.
Bloodless for now.
It's all tendencies that have been there for centuries in civilization. It's just in the last 10 years have been amplified.
I'm keeping mine with the altruist, putting my weight behind the dancer. I know it's hard to be an optimist when you trust least the ones who claim to have the answers. It's an uncivil war.
And when people say, oh, artists have a duty, I bristle a little bit because artists don't tend to do things out of duty, or they probably shouldn't, but if they care about what's happening around them, then that should come out in their work naturally, just mm-hmm. in an organic way.
You've written about your songwriting process, and one of the things you've talked about is the process you go through after you've discovered a new melody. Can you kind of walk us through how you develop a melody into a song?
Yeah. For instance, the melody to Sisyphus, the whistle melody, started out as the melody to Bloodless.
Interesting.
So early on, the melodies are not very faithful to any one song. And if sometimes they get snubbed, and which is what happened with Bloodless, it got kind of crowded in there and it jumped to Sisyphus and it actually worked. But actually, if you whistle that melody over Bloodless, it works just as well. And that's why an album hangs together sometimes thematically, not just lyrically, but with melodies and ideas, is that if it sounds familiar later on in the record, it's because they used to be in the same song.
Yeah, so it's one way of sort of getting kind of this unity, this through line throughout the album.
Yeah.
Do you believe that this album is your finest work yet?
Sure.
Yeah?
You know,
yeah.
I've said that before, which is part of the joke, you know?
Like, mm-hmm.
It's every time you're about to put something out in the world, you're like, I feel very proud of it, but I thought I'd just come out and say it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. puts a lot of pressure on you for the next album, though, right? Because that's got to be your finest work.
The last word in that phrase is yet.
Yet, yes.
So it sounds a bit arrogant, but then you kind of pick it apart and you're like, oh, well. It'll be tough to name the next record, that's the thing.
Yeah, that's going to be tough, yeah, yeah. Andrew Bird's latest album is called My Finest Work Yet. You can find out more about Andrew on our website, wpr.org/beta.
Particularly with Orange World, you know, I really felt like that was emotional realism. And if there's a devil inside it, it's just in the service of telling a true story.
Karen Russell talks about her latest short story collection, Orange World. I'm Doug Gordon. And this is Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Karen Russell is a MacArthur Foundation genius. Her novel Swamplandia was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. Now she has a new collection of short stories called Orange World. Karen's stories are often surprising and surreal, and many of them deal with nature and the physical world.
You know, it's a funny thing with the collection. I think for the first couple stories, you're just kind of rediscovering what your preoccupations are. And part of the thrill of kind of working on stories over this kind of long stretch of time is you start to see what notes recur, and then you can kind of consciously build out these connections.
How much of your interest in the natural world do you think comes from being born and raised in Florida?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, probably 100%.
Yeah.
I was just looking through some old photographs, actually. My dad is in town, and it was such a nice reminder that, wow, we really did have this unbelievable childhood in South Florida. There was a picture of my siblings and I watching this albino peacock walk down our street.
Oh, wow.
This was just like a normal occurrence, you know?
Yeah.
We were lucky enough that we lived right by the water, and we lived by this kind of mangrove estuary that we called the Muck. And what was exciting about that place as a kid, it was like a little swamp and microcosm, sort of. But, totally liminal place, you know, very unclear where the land ended and where the ocean began. And our neighbor had kind of this muddy canal running behind his house, which, you know, as a mother now, it would terrify me to let my kids play by. But
yeah,
it was really just, you know, there were always kind of blue heron and all kinds of exciting crustaceans. And Florida, you know, for people who have visited, everyone's aware that it's really inescapable. You can't deny that you're a part of nature. The humidity alone is always just engulfing you.
Your stories are so grounded in the physical world, and your settings are so richly textured and so three-dimensional. Is setting the first place your imagination goes to when you're creating a story?
Yeah, I mean, more often than not, it really is. I think maybe in my first collection, there were a few more stories that began as kind of what would happen if counterfactuals. But really, I think I need to have some sense of the landscape before I feel comfortable starting anything. I mean, even before I know the characters, sometimes I need to kind of have a sense of, you know, what setting am I going to cordon off in this particular story? What's the world going to be?
Yeah. So then once you've decided on what the world is going to be, so how do you go about deciding what kind of characters should inhabit each of these various worlds?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's always a surprise, too, a little bit, you know.
So you don't put a lot of thought, you don't create character biographies or anything, and you don't do that. You just sort of go into it and start writing?
Yeah, I think I have to sort of. That's the only way I know how to get to know these people, and it can take multiple drafts. You know, there's a story in here, the tornado auction, and I had gone on this kind of research trip to Nebraska, to the sandhills of Nebraska, and I made a good friend out there, Doug Johnson, who just took me up in his crop duster and introduced me sort of to this incredible world. And I got to meet some older kind of ranchers and farmers in the area, And so in that case, you know, there's the voice in that story. It's this kind of 76-year-old retired breeder of literal weather, of actual tornadoes.
Yeah.
But he's sort of an amalgam of some of these real people that I met out there.
I just love the idea that these people are bidding. It's similar to a horse auction, isn't it? Like, these people are bidding on tornadoes.
Yes.
It's such a great premise, and you execute it so well. Yeah, I want to ask you about The Bad Graft. Can you give us kind of a brief synopsis of this story without revealing any or very few spoilers?
Oh, sure. So this is a crazy story that I had been thinking for a while. I wanted to try to revise one of these myths from the Metamorphoses. And the one that I was haunted by was Daphne and Apollo, right? So Apollo chases Daphne, and she makes this kind of cruel existential bargain where she survives, but it's by becoming a tree, which just felt very resonant to me as kind of a strategy that many people use, you know, if you want to kind of extend the metaphor to what we see people do kind of after, you know, when they're threatened, when they're traumatized. But I wanted to sort of flip it and reverse it and imagine what it would be like if a tree made a leap into a human woman, you know, how that might work.
Yeah.
So I had been thinking about this idea for a little bit, and I went on my first date with my now husband to Joshua Tree National Park and just felt completely resized and terrified in a wonderful way by the desert. I had never seen this particular desert before. I hadn't really spent that much time in this kind of ecosystem, and I thought it was thrilling. So this is like a long-winded synopsis, but the story is kind of a love triangle between a very young couple that are on a road trip. They think that they're going to be kind of vagabonds and wanderers. And then on this trip, the girl pricks her finger on a Joshua tree. There's this uncanny merger. She is infiltrated by the plant's spirit. And the story sort of proceeds from there. It's a very unstable geometry between this woman, the tree spirit, and her boyfriend.
Yeah, and that finger prick, that's like straight out of Grimm's fairy tales, isn't it?
Isn't it, though?
Yeah, yeah. It's great, though. But the story just, wow, that story really, well, they all did, but I mean, that one really knocked me out, and now would be a great time to have you read an excerpt from it.
Oh, sure thing.
And you can set it up if you like.
So this is right after that kind of fairy tale moment where she pricks her finger on a spine of this ancient tree. At first, the Joshua tree is elated to discover that it's alive. I survived my leap. I was not annihilated. Whatever I was. Grafted to the girl's consciousness, the plant becomes aware of itself. It dreams its green way up into her eye stalks and peers out. Standing there, in the mirror of the desert, are 100 versions of itself. Here is its home, a six-armed hulk, fibrous and fruiting obscenely under a noon sun. Here is the locust that recently contained this tree spirit. For a tree, this is a dreadful experience. Its uprooted awareness floats throughout the alien form. It concentrates itself behind Angie's eyeballs, where there's moisture. This insoluble spirit, this refugee from the Joshua tree, understands itself to have leapt into hell, the wrong place, the wrong vessel. It pulses outward in a fuzzy frenzy of investigation, flares greener, sends out feelers. Compared with the warm and expansive desert soil, the human body is a cul-de-sac. This newborn ghost has only just begun to apprehend itself when its fragile tendency is threatened. Angie sneezes, rubs at her temple. Unaware that this is an immunologic reflex, she is convulsed by waves of nostalgia for earlier selves, remote homes. Here, for some reason, is her childhood backyard, filled with anarchic wildflowers and bordered by Pennsylvania hemlock. Then the pain dismantles her memory. She holds her head in her hand, cries for Andy. This is the plant fighting back. The girl moans, "Andy, don't you have any medicine, Advil, something?" The vegetable invader feels the horror of its imprisonment. Its new host is walking away from the Joshua tree forest, following Andy. What can this kind of survival mean?
I'm curious about how you go about inhabiting the mind of a Joshua Tree. I'm guessing that one of the biggest challenges would be trying not to Disney-fy it, not to anthropomorphize the tree.
Oh, it's very tricky, isn't it? There was a fabulous, it's a classic of kind of science fiction, John Wyndham's The Day of the Triffids.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I read that years ago. So was that on your mind at all when you wrote this?
I must have been deep in the very back, you know, in the deep folds of the brain or something. It's tough for me to source sometimes, you know, what the influences are. But I do sort of think imagining a very different kind of way of existing, you know, grafting onto a human being. One of the things that was challenging but pleasurable was sort of thinking about what would that estranged perspective make of the way humans live in time, you know, the speed at which we're moving through time, how totally unmoored we are, you know, relative to something like an ancient tree with this vast kind of root system. And so in a way, you know, I really nerded out on kind of learning about this incredible millennial love story between a particular species of moth and the Joshua tree. And that gave me a way to think about what's beautiful but also maybe terrifying about really grappling with how profoundly interdependent we all are. You know, you have this illusion that you're this discrete entity, and then you discover, no, my borders are totally porous. And, you know, in the case of this honeymooning couple, I think there is something terrifying, right, about saying I'm going to yoke my life to another person's life and our fates will be intertwined.
Oh, yeah.
That's sort of the shadow side of a love story, right, that it can kind of shade into a horror story at certain moments, if you're dealing with this kind of collision of instinct. So I did want to just think about, and I had a lot of fun thinking about what a Joshua tree would find upsetting or hilarious or maybe familiar about being a human being.
Another one of the standout stories is The Gondoliers. Can you tell us a bit about this one?
Yeah, I'm so happy you enjoyed it because this story nearly broke me. It just took me a very long time to sort of navigate my own way through.
It's about your home state?
I just think I was very stubbornly committed to sort of the wrong trajectory for this story for a while. You know, you kind of dig in, and even the wrong point of view for a while. And so I had to make my peace with sort of starting afresh a little bit. But the world of the story has always been the same, and it's a drowned South Florida in a near-ish future. And it's told from the point of view of one of four sisters they're sort of these mutant women who have evolved and kind of consciously evolved this ability to navigate the canals of this new Florida by echolocating. So, you know, they sing and the echoes of their voices return to them kind of a map of submerged objects and obstacles, and that they're able to sort of anticipate what the river is going to do next and move with it. I love the idea of these kind of chorusing women, this secret power that's kind of developing inside of them and between them.
Yeah. You write such beautiful sentences, and it makes me think of one of my favorite quotes about sentences is from Don DeLillo. The quote is, "The sentences I'm working on generate the ideas that tend to lead to more sentences." Does that quote resonate with you?
I love that. Yeah. Yes. You know, Charlie D'Ambrosio is somebody else who, he's just an artist of the sentence. And I've heard him say, you know, it's almost, he follows the sound first, and with luck, the music leads him to the meaning.
Yeah.
And I really do find that to be true in a funny way. I have to kind of be conscious of how much I love rhymes and half rhymes. No, you know, nobody wants to inadvertently write a story-length lullaby.
Yeah.
But there is something about following like a round sound forward, and it can, in like a rainbow scarf kind of way, you know, lead to another thought and another thought. And it's surprising the kind of circuitry of sound, what it can lead you to.
Yeah. Let's talk about the title story, Orange World. Can you give us kind of a Cliff's Notes summary of Orange World?
Yeah. This was a real new kind of story to try for me. And in some ways, I thought maybe the riskiest story for me to try to write. And it's a story about this woman who has a difficult pregnancy and makes a deal with the devil, she believes, to protect her son, to ensure that her son will be born healthy. And then sort of finds herself getting blackmailed by this huckster demon who the deal is that as long as she nurses him every night, he'll make sure that her son doesn't die.
Now would be a great time to have you read an excerpt.
The gutter is a cold canoe. Ray lowers onto an elbow, stretching flat. Asphalt pushes at her shoulders, her tailbone. It seems impossible that she hasn't gotten sick yet in all these weeks of appointments. Perhaps the devil is keeping her well. She tries not to look at it. When she looks at it, her milk dries up. It lays its triangular head on her collarbone, using its thin-fingered paws to squeeze milk from her left breast into its hairy snout. Its tail curls around her waist. Unlike her son, the devil has dozens of irregular teeth, fanged and broken, in three rows. Some lie flat against the gums, like bright arrowheads in green mud. Its lips make a cold collar around her nipple. She feels the tugging deep in her groin, a menstrual aching. Milk gushes out of her, more milk than it seems any single body could possibly produce. More milk, she's sure, than her baby ever gets. Below her, the devil makes a queer, gurgling sound. Tonight, it has a long, paddle-like tail, erratically needled, like a balding cactus, which lashes at her side. She feels blood racing away from a fresh cut. It drinks. More milk floods around its lips, turning its fur shiny and wet.
This story reminded me of Ira Levin's novel, Rosemary's Baby, and the movie based on it. Your story kind of seems like a sequel, Rosemary's Baby Part 2. Was Rosemary's Baby on your mind at all when you were writing
this?
Yeah,
it must have been. It's so funny, isn't it? You sort of don't always know, I think, what the mulch is.
Right, because you're too busy down there in the weeds but creating the story. So,
right.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes when people talk about influence, you know, there's a temptation to want to just to say, well, it was Nabokov, obviously, you know, or just sort of you want to cite these literary greats. But part of the horror in this story for me, it was just, I don't know that I had been connected before to that kind of, this sense of animal pleading, you know, where you so desperately want for the, but I think that must be what, you know, that's not just limited to, you know, new motherhood. I think anyone who has ever been in that bargaining room, where you're suddenly evicted from your ordinary day and you find yourself just on a threshold where you are pleading with whatever is listening to help a loved one or to help yourself, right?
Yeah.
That state has to be universal, I think. And I have been just thinking, you know, more globally, you know, you see the way that fear makes people very vulnerable to all kinds of exploitation, you know, and control. So for me, this story really, I mean, in a very, it's pretty literal. You know, there is like this actual scabby devil that keeps showing up in this woman's gutter.
Yeah. It's also very funny, though, as many of your stories are. It's also very funny, and you have this really uncanny knack to combine horror and humor in your work. How do you do that?
Oh, I hope so. I think that can be a little bit of a tricky thing, you know, but sometimes I also feel if something is just too monotone, if it's only dark, or if it's just you know a laugh a minute, it both can feel false to me in a way, you know, because I just think it's almost like the way you keep toggling a hologram.
Yeah,
you know, the very same thing can seem there. Maybe there's something hilarious about it, and just like deadly serious, very frightening.
I think it's only a matter of time until the word Russell-esque is added to dictionaries to describe your writing style. So
I hope it's not a pejorative.
I thought it would be a good idea to submit a definition to Merriam-Webster's and Oxford. And so I've taken the liberty of coming up with a rough draft of a definition. Would you mind if I ran it by you?
Oh, no way.
Here we go. Well, yeah, but you haven't heard it yet. But remember, it's a first draft. Here we go. Okay. Russell-esque. Characteristic or reminiscent of the fiction of Karen Russell. Fantastical, surreal realism that uses liminal distortions to find the truth. Haunting, hallucinatory, and humorous. Am I on the right track?
I love that. I love surreal realism.
It's a start, but how would you describe your work?
Oh, I thank you for that. You know, I do get asked a lot about sort of fantasy versus realism, and that binary always feels a little reductive and phony to me because... Yeah. If you're trying to write about anything at all, it's to come at the complexity and strangeness of this life, you know? And yeah, I think some of those distinctions start to break down a little bit for me. And for these characters, you know, often it's true that they're inhabiting some alternate world where, you know, a tree spirit can possess a woman's body, or, you know, you can dance with ghosts on a mountainside, or, you know, a devil might show up outside your house. But particularly with Orange World, you know, I really felt like that was emotional realism. And if there's a devil inside it, it's just in the service of telling a true story.
Karen Russell is the author of the short story collection Orange World. You can find out more about Karen at wpr.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
That's just flavor to a high life man.
Special thanks to our producer, Carl Christensen.
Carl, did somebody check my name?
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
You know, for once, I'm a good guy. I like this humility. It's good.
Adam Friedrich is the show's executive producer.
I am not cloying. I am not needy. I don't care what you think. You're not getting to me.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
So now suddenly you're going to be an artist. Well, be an artist on your own time.